Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
You're listening to Radio 3. No, it is 5 Live, it's okay. Good morning. You're listening to the very last Saturday edition of Wittertainment until the next World Cup, where maybe we're going to be doing it again. As you might have noticed, we're in a slightly different studio because normally there isn't room for a piano. What's this one now you're playing?
Oh, this is the theme from Silent Running.
Silent Running now. So we're going to start with a selection of hits from the movies. No, I don't recognise that. Any Chopin?
Chopin, how does that go? No, I can do...
How about some Chaz and Dave from the sideboard song era?
Have a banana.
That'll do. Mark will now shuffle over to where he's supposed to be, where we will be doing movie reviews between now and midday. This is 5 Live. We have Wittertainment for you. We're doing some movie reviews. Everything changes for the World Cup. We're back next Friday in our usual slot, which I think is between 2 and 4, but I forget these things.
It's just so funny being such a big enough studio to have a grand piano and to be able to wave one's arms around without fear of hitting anything at all. I can't make the...
And we know how large they are. So on the programme before 12, we're going to be talking to David Slade, the director of Eclipse, which is the new Twilight movie, and also speak to one of the new baddies, who is Xavier Samuel, though, as you're going to hear, he corrects my pronunciation, and it's Xavier Samuel, who plays Riley Byers, who was in The Good Life, of course. We'll do the box office top 10 slightly earlier than normal. Let's just have a look at some of the correspondence here. Dr. Nadia Hussein, first of all, professor in physiology. Mm-hmm. Simon and Mark, I download your weekly podcast and listen to it in delicious segments and repeats as I drive to and from work every day. Since my daily commute is 200 kilometres to and from Dubai, I have a lot of time on my hands.
Blimey.
Before your podcast, and as a sleep-deprived researcher, I would often fall asleep at the wheel, and if I had continued, I would surely end up in an accident on the highway one day. Now I listen and laugh along with your podcast. It keeps me up on the road, and so perhaps I am the only listener who can say, you have saved my life, and genuinely claim it. So this is the programme and the podcast that can save your life.
But there's a terrible pressure there, because it means that if we start getting boring, she might fall asleep and come off the road.
So, Dr. Hussein, thank you. If there is anybody else, actually, who can also claim that in some way we have saved your life, do get in touch. Dear Frank and little Frank, yep. This is Phil Pemberton. He was very dear to many people. Having been an avid podcast listener for time out of my mind, I know that Dr. Kermode is not averse to reading comments about himself on the interweb. Therefore, I was shocked to see, as he no doubt was, that his star rating on the Internet Movie Database website has recently dropped by 12%.
So what is this star rating?
I've got no idea. Okay. You're claiming not to know.
No, I know what the Internet Movie Database is, but...
I can only surmise that this is due to his recent wobblings over 3D, his positive reviews of MOR fare, middle of the road fare, such as Get Me to the Greek and Letters to Juliet, and his mewlings to Simon about being treated cruelly by his long-suffering host. It's time he got his mojo back. Can we have him on a weekend trip to Las Vegas with Danny Dyer, McGee, and pre-Sherlock Holmes Guy Ritchie?
Well, I mean...
Where's the real Mark Kermode?
Well, I'm here.
Well, the assumption is, from Phil Pemberton here, that...
I've gone soft.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I've always been soft in the... I've always been a man who loves Dougal and the Blue Cat and Local Hero and, you know, Silent Running. So.
Phil says, a note on a past riff about Mark's appearance on the front cover of the Manchester University Alumni magazine. I now live in London and only see it when I'm at my mum's house on my infrequent visits back to Manchester. Picking it up a month ago, my sister-in-law looked at the cover and said, oh, it's him. I liked having tutorials with him. Thinking it must have been for his erudite observations, I wanted more details. Yes, it was great, she said. He just talked all the way through them and everyone else just sat there. Simon will no doubt empathise with this, but it is the kind of ranting that we've been missing a little of late. Well, you haven't been listening, Phil, because it has been there. But how fascinating to find out that actually even all those years ago when you were just a student, you ranted and raved and dominated and took over pretty much as now?
Well, I think I filled the available space on the fear that if there was any silence, you know, the auto transmitters would kick in and we'd be listening to Kenny G playing Songbird. Oh, is that just Radio 1?
Kenny G and Songbird, that's in the Obit box.
Okay, fine.
If anyone dies, that might still be in the 5-5 Obit box. We might have to dig that out.
If you were Kenny G and you'd recorded Songbird, wouldn't you be cross that was the only time your song was able to be played?
Yeah. Your song forever associated with very big, sad state occasions.
Exactly, yes.
Right, now we're going to do the box office top 10 now,
yeah.
Because, as we mentioned before, we have some Twilight conversations to cover. Indeed, it's Twiglet 3, isn't it? Let's go back to that. Okay, so box office top 10 this week, including at 10, Wild Target.
Which, you know, isn't anything like as funny as it ought to be. And there's a bunch of people in it who I quite like, but it is all over the place and kind of messy, which is a shame.
Robin Hood hanging on in there at number 9.
Yeah, he has done much better than I thought. It was funny.
Much better than you thought, even though I said this is going to do quite well. And you said, well, we'll see.
If you hadn't jumped in, yeah. I was about to say...
Yeah.
It's done well enough to prove that you were correct and I was wrong.
Yeah.
Because I said, I don't think it'll do well. And you said, I think it will. And I said, well, we'll see who's right. Mm. And it turns out that you were right.
Thank you.
So let me take this moment to say, you were right. It doesn't mean the film's great, but you were right.
And we save lives.
Yes.
The programme and the podcast.
I have gone soft there, haven't I? Because I am now saying you're right.
Letters to Juliet is at 8.
Which I enjoyed. More further evidence of my going soft in the centre. I kind of enjoyed it. I know it's all over the place. I know it's a mess. But Vanessa Redgrave is Vanessa Redgrave. And it's very moving when she reminisces about her life. And actually, every moment she's on screen, I can watch it perfectly fine. It's a shame that the guy who's playing the English guy doesn't have a good English accent. But, you know, it is what it is. Many critics got very cross about that film and actually really didn't like it at all. I don't know how you can get worked up about a film as totally harmless as Letters to Juliet.
The Collector at 7.
Which is horrible. I mean, horrible and stupid. And is the worst thing about The Collector is this. It's one of those, you know, it's from the people who wrote Saw or some of the Saw movies. And basically, it's people trapped in a house which has been totally booby-trapped, and a guy breaks into a house to discover that in the house already is the Collector. And people occasionally say stupid things like, he's the Collector. What do you mean? Well, if he likes you, you'll stay alive. And then there's just like 30 minutes of, you know, machines tearing people apart. And then you go, what? A, what do you mean he's the Collector? B, how do you know that? C, what evidence is there for it? But what? No. It's like they had a title. It's like the Collector. Fine. But we'll have a bunch of torturing things and a bunch of machines, a bunch of clockwork. What are you going to call it? The Collector? They might as well have called it the Train Spotter. He's the Train Spotter. Why is that? Well, if you look like a train, you live. You know, horrible, stupid, nasty.
And as titles go, it's not brilliant.
No.
I mean, it might explain something, but it's not.
It's not John Fowles.
Death at a Funeral at 6.
Which I still haven't seen. I apologise, but I...
How long is it going to take you
because
to see
Because there
this?
Was 8-9 movies out this week.
Oh, no, how terrible. And you're a full-time film critic.
I know, it's awful, isn't it?
That must be, what, a couple of films a day? That'll be... Oh, we'll just fit that
Monday
one in
and
then.
Tuesday are 5 films a day.
Oh, dear. Street Dance 3D at 5.
I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I liked it very much. In fact, of all the 3D movies that I'd seen, it was one that I thought worked best in 3D until I saw Toy Story 3D, which was the film that made me forget I was watching 3D, although that does make me question whether there's any point in 3D.
Toy Story, a lot of correspondence on that already. When do we get to Toy Story?
It's not for a few weeks yet.
A lot of emails from people who've seen it and have some very interesting comments, but we'll hold on to that. Prince of Persia, Sands of Time at 4.
Shorter and better than Pirates of the Caribbean. You see that Pirates of the Caribbean 4 is apparently still ongoing, so our campaign to get people to walk past the production office and shout stop it clearly hasn't worked.
3 is Sex and the City 2.
Horrible.
Killers at 2.
Not funny. The big problem with Killers is it's just not funny, and I wanted it to be sort of, you know, charming and witty and jolly and lively, and it's boring and stupid and ugly and crass, and it's a shame because I wanted it to be, you know, a good bit of counter-programming for people that weren't interested in the World Cup, which apparently we're not in anymore.
No, so there's a lot of people speculating that actually the big movies, you know, now is the time. The weather's, you know, it's okay, but the World Cup is...
Do you think that the England team threw the game in order to give the Twiglet premiere a little bit of space?
It's great coincidence. It's great timing.
Thank you very much. It's too
indeed.
Big to just be coincidence,
it's
isn't
a theory
it?
That has been under-discussed. UK's number one, Get Him to the Greek.
Which is fine. The problem with it is that the times that it works is essentially Russell Brand doing that riff that he does. I still think he's funnier than any of the movies he's been in. I still think they're looking for a vehicle which will properly use his talents. So it's very patchy, and it's not as consistently funny as it needs to be. But I did, you know, smirk, chortle, I guffawed once, And but generally there was a sort of...
Gafur is bigger than...
Gafur is like that, you know. I did do one of them. But generally there were periods of silence, but interspersed with little outbreaks of amusement, which actually in the marketplace at the moment is not bad.
In a moment, we're going to bring you some Saturday morning wittertainment with some Twiglet guests, a director and a newborn vampire, no less.
Doesn't he own a shirt?
I'm good here. You should go.
I'm not going to be gone long.
Don't rush. You need to hunt. Maybe rush a little bit.
Hey, beautiful.
Hi.
A clip from Eclipse, which is the latest in the Twilight saga. David Slade is the director, and he joins us. How are you doing, David?
I'm all right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us in our new, very spacious studio here.
It's huge, isn't it?
And Xavier Samuel, who plays Riley Briers, is here as well. Hello, Xavier, how are you?
I'm very well indeed, thank you for having me.
Do you want to correct them on your spelling of your pronunciation of your name?
No, Xavier works well. It's usually Xavier, but...
I call him Excalibur.
Okay, you just put me down right at the start of the interview, Dave. We're just trying to get on and everything.
I'm sorry, mate.
Okay, hang about a minute. How do you pronounce my surname?
Commode.
No,
Commode. Wrong.
See,
yeah,
one all. 15 love.
I'm Simon. You're David. You are
Xavier,
and you're Mark.
Thank
you. Look, we're supposed to be talking about your film.
Sorry.
Set us up for the beginning of your movie. Where have we got to in the saga, Dave?
Well, in the last film, Edwards was really miserable and upset about stuff, and so was Bella. And
for a great long period of time.
For a great long period of time. And they were all very kind of miserable and stuff. And they missed each other and stuff, and one of them ran all the way around the world and stuff. And I'm not very good at this.
No,
you should have done the talking book for New Moon. That would have been great. Yeah, and they're just a bit grumpy. And then
You're clearly right in the target audience, though, because so many of the people who will be going to see this film will say, yeah, it was good and stuff. So you're speaking exactly the way the audience are going to be speaking.
Yeah, I know. It's from living in America for 8 years, I get, and stuff.
Added on. But you're quite right about Bella being miserable.
She wasn't too happy in the second one.
But I said to my daughter,
she was waking up screaming all the time, and she was, like, sitting on that chair for, like, a whole year. Remember that? Yeah. She was sat on this chair, and, like, a whole year went by.
Being really glum.
And I was like, didn't she go to the bathroom or eat or anything? You know? But she didn't. And at the point being, though, that you know, they go through that, and that's this whole, you know, emotional kind of bonding for them. And so we opened this film with a really dark and exciting sequence featuring Excalibur here on the right of me. But then we start with the Oasis, a really nice, lovely, warm place. It's like one of the only times in the Twilight saga that they're actually very happy together. And then from that point, things go very, 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 very downhill.
Right, so it starts fine and gets miserable from there.
Not miserable, no. Just
dark.
Kind of dark, full of vengeance and excitement and, you know, tragedy and romance.
Mr. Samuel, just explain where you come in, then explain your part of the story here.
Well, I play a newborn vampire called Riley, who has got his hands full trying to control a bloodthirsty clan of newborn vampires and marching on the path to destruction and revenge. So just your average kind of day, really.
Right, so just explain a newborn vampire and the power contained therein.
Well, what happens when you become a newborn vampire? You're extremely bloodthirsty and vicious and incredibly strong. So they come in very handy if you happen to be assembling an army.
You know, like when you started at Radio 1. That's like a newborn.
Newborn vampire?
Yeah.
Me and Bruno Brooks.
Vicious and incredibly strong.
I don't really think you're quite there. Now, this is part trois, and you've already used the dark word, and a number of people are using the dark word to describe part three in comparison with part one and
abject?
Two. No, it's getting darker.
Oh, you mean actually literally the word dark? Right, yes.
How much darker is part three?
It's actually, I wouldn't say it's dark so much as more of a realistic, more perhaps grown-up, mature film, and with that, in that, rather than things being black and white, there are greater shades of grey. And with those, you know, come those paranoias and those darker tones, I would say, there is conspiracy. There is, for the first time, we don't take the fact that lives are in danger lightly. We say, look, people are going to die. That's quite a lot at stake. And I think that was one of the things coming in as director that I really focused on wanting to do was try and make it as realistic as possible, particularly in the stakes. You know, it's, you know, you take on a film that's a fantasy, and it's very easy to say, well, you know, it's a fantasy, so we'll just kind of, you know, drift through this in ways, and we'll make sure that we hit this beat and that beat, and it'll be really exciting. But for me, I kind of took the opposite approach, and I went for a more realistic film, as if it was a drama, and said, well, you know, we're training here for a battle. These people could die because of your decisions, and this has got to weigh heavily on you. So when I I tried to put a third dimension into it in that kind of way.
Dr. Kermit.
Well, I think the other thing to say, it's important, I know a lot of people have said darkness, but I think the crucial thing through all this is that at the centre of it is a love story. It is a story about true love. And David and I spoke on the phone recently. I've interviewed David before when he made Hard Candy, which I really, really like. And I said, you know, it's great to see a film that is genuinely about true love. And you said something which is quite sweet. You said, yeah, it's funny. Actually, people do like things that are nice.
Yes,
people do actually, you know, embrace that positive. I think that's one thing that's important. I think the other thing that's important, and I have no qualms about saying this, I think it's the best of the Twilight films, and I've liked the first two very much. What I really like about this is that actually Bella's character becomes much more the defining driving force. I mean, people have complained in the past that she mopes and whinges and complains. Actually, what happens, as you'll know from the story of Eclipse, is that her decisions, it becomes much more about her deciding her own destiny, her choosing her own path. And because of your sort of, you know, your feet in the 30 Days of Night and the Vampire, you know how to do action fantasy sequences.
Just on that point, because you've done vampires before, David, just on the 30 Days of Night, remind us about that and how much of that has influenced the way you do this.
Well, I mean, having done a vampire film before, it does kind of clue you into the fact that you really can't just assume anything about these vampires. We did take the pathology of them very, very seriously, meaning that we kind of had to figure out what made them tick, how, you know, what their routines would be. And Xavier and I talked a lot about, you know, for instance, his transformation from human to vampire, and we actually did little emotional diagrams of what was it, rage, you know, disappointment to envy, rage, frenzy, you know, and how he would go through all of these different emotions to get to that kind of frenzy that would allow you to make your first kill, for instance. But also on another level, you know, what they're made of. You know, they sparkle in the sunlight, we know this much, and we're going to take it very seriously. So what's the pathology of that? So we did these like cross sections, like Damien Hirst's, with this fantastic visual effects company called Image Engine, who did a lot of work on District 9, which is a film I loved last year. And, you know, we did this, you know, whole pathological study. Similarly to when I did 30 Days of Night, we kind of went through and tracked the history of this particular vampire as a species rather than a transformed human backwards. And so it makes you really think about everything. And it all informs story. All of it has to inform story. It's not just fun. You know, as we go through the story, we know we're going to this great, big, huge, violent, you know, clash. So, for instance, you know, we wanted to figure out, well, how often do they hunt? What happens when they hunt? Well, you know what? Mama Cullen, she goes out and she rips bears apart at night, you know, and she comes home and she's very nice. But, you know, and I just remember sitting with Elizabeth Reese, who plays that part, and she says, so, well, am I able to fight? You know, what am I? She says, yeah, of course you do. You rip mountain lions apart. She's like, oh, yeah, I do, don't I? You know, but you know, beyond that, they're made of crystal. And, you know, all of these things come from having gone through something with the mythology, you know, and having to kind of really try and... I've probably gone in way too long now, haven't I?
No. Hey, you're the director. When you stopped, I'll bring Xavier in, but you keep going.
Is he like this on set, incidentally? Does he just do this forever?
We'll take that as a yes.
Just in rehearsal. Really.
Just in rehearsal. Yeah, but I mean, that's one of the things I love about the approach is that we kind of, especially for my character, went, look, what's happened here? You know, this guy's kind of had his humanity snatched away from him, and as a result is harbouring this kind of intense jealousy and rage. And so it was kind of great to have these sorts of discussions and actually approach the character, you know, and kind of pay tribute to its complexity, you know, as opposed to delving into cliches.
And how tough is it to act out a transition then, which David was talking about, that, you know, when you do make that transition, what do you have to do? What did he ask you to do?
Well, it's such a meticulous thing, like, because it's very fragile each moment. So, I mean, I just felt in really safe hands, and I think that's the most important thing is you know that there's that trust there, and then we just kind of we work through it and really pay attention to the details of each moment.
Have you seen David's previous films?
Absolutely.
Have you seen Hard Candy?
I love it. I think it's an amazing film. And what I love about it is how measured the performances are throughout the film, which is exactly what you're referring to. I mean, there's so many opportunities for actors to spend it all at once, and I think David has a really wonderful grip on the way a performance kind of operates throughout the course of a film.
It's also significant that Hard Candy has at its centre this kind of, you know, troubled teenager who who defines their own world and is, you know, and I mean, it's the whole point about Hard Candy is it turns the tables on what your expectations are. You think she's going to be the victim. Actually, she turns out to be completely the opposite.
In many ways, yeah. And it was funny, when I first went in to talk with the studio about doing this film, and I went in going, I have no idea why on earth they'd think of me. No idea whatsoever. You know, obviously, you know, my body of work, you know, small as it is, doesn't really suggest that I would take on a Twilight film. They did talk about Hard Candy, and they talked to us particularly about the performances and about wanting to keep that intensity. And I was like, oh, all right then. Well, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes total sense. It is actually, if you're happy with that, if you're happy with me taking a very dramatic, you know, approach to this film, a very cinematic approach, and I think the two go hand in hand. I don't like to use the words mise-en-scene, but, you know, the idea of... of you know all
but let's
of the
use it anyway.
Well, yeah, I'm using it anyway. All of the elements of the film actually creating a vocabulary, which actually, you know, become the emotional feel of the entire film, and saying, well, I'm actually not going to make this kind of very popcorny thing. I'm actually going to take it very seriously, and it's going to come across. You know, there's going to be by, you know, there's just that there is going to be an element of that popcorny stuff left of it, but we're going to take quite a high road, and we're going to go for a very, very serious, very straight drama.
Now, we've all been getting on very well, and Mark's been behaving himself, which is always very good. But I came across a quote, David, from you, which I just want to mention at this point. We haven't mentioned our Pats yet. We haven't mentioned Robert Pattinson.
You're going to hit me with the not with a...
You called him a modern-day Elvis.
I didn't.
Well...
No, David was talking about me when he said that. He said I was a modern-day Elvis.
Did I do that? Yeah. I mean, I may well have done that. I can't...
Okay, well, let me phrase it differently. Do you think he's a modern-day Elvis?
Rob, he could well be. He's certainly got charisma. I'll give that to him. He has got a charisma. He has got this kind of wicked sense of humour, which I know Elvis did. He was a bit of a dark. He was a bit on the dark side, and he's got the looks. I don't know whether it was a different time. I don't think there's a good. I don't think there's a good comparison. Although I will tell you. I will divert this question into a different department and tell you an anecdote. I was just in Madrid, and I was doing a red carpet there, and someone came in and said, "We have Rob Pattinson here. Do you believe us?" And I was like, sure, I'll believe anything at this point, because this whole Twilight phenomenon is actually blowing my mind. And they pulled out a bat, and what they were saying was Robert Pattinson, and it was a real live vampire bat.
Hilarious.
It was funnier if you were there.
I said,
"Don't put our guest down."
No, I'm not saying the story is hilarious. I mean, the idea of suddenly being confronted by a real live vampire bat.
What are you going to do?
What did you do?
Well, I said, "Stay there," and I'm just going to go and get my camera. Don't move. And I ran and got my camera and took a photograph of it. Which
we have to finish. Xavier, presumably you are now fully prepared for what's about to happen, for this phenomena to be unleashed, for the screams. I still remember going to the first film, going to the premiere of that, and then coming out of the tube and hearing the screams from about 500 yards away. I mean, it is going to, your life is going to change if it hasn't changed already.
I'm not sure how you prepare for something like that.
Mark and I could scream at you now.
Yeah. Should we try?
That would help.
I'll scream, I'll join in.
Okay, after three. 1, 2, 3.
Wow, I feel much better now.
Sign my arm, please.
I'm so glad you said arm.
Ready to go into the fray, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
Excalibur, can I ask a question of you?
Absolutely.
How long did it take to get that sword out of the stone?
Can I ask a closing question of you?
Yeah, of course.
How great is Andrzej Żuławski's possession?
Let's just narrow it down.
He said mise en scene. I can go strange
absolutely.
Polish filmmaker.
Now, I've got to say, I am a fan of your show. I'll say that without any shame at all. I'm a big fan. I do watch it on the internet, even though I'm living in Los Angeles. And it was, I think it was the Antichrist, the thing you did on Antichrist, and you talked a lot about possession. And it just sounded like my cup of tea, and I ended up asking a few people. It's impossible to get, and I'm telling you, it became my probably second favourite film of all time, and so influential. And not just because it involves a little monster that looks very realistic and very disturbing, but the performances were just for a director. Possession is such an enigma because the performances are so over the top, yet so absolutely perfect for the film. And if nobody knows what we're talking about, this film is called Possession. It's directed by, you'll pronounce it
better. Andrzej Żuławski.
And it's a film made in the 80s. It has Isabella Adjani and Sam Neill. And it's just astounding. If you're a horror fan and you haven't seen this film, you're not a horror fan, but you must go out and get a copy of it somehow or borrow it from somewhere. And I think Mark's hypothesis was, and I think I agree with it now, that Lars von Trier really probably studied that film before he went out to make Possession. Antichrist.
Yeah, right. I agree.
We're out of time. David Slade, thank you very much indeed. Xavier Sammy, appreciate that. So the movie previews this weekend.
It does.
Today, in fact.
Yes. Ahead of this being
July.
The weekend.
Yes.
And then it comes out on the
9th of July.
9th of July.
David, Xavier, thank you very much indeed. And now Wittertainment continues. Here we are in our Saturday morning slot for the last time until the next World Cup or European Championships or something big and sporty knocks us off Friday afternoon. Remember, as it proved in the last half hour, we are the programme that can save your life. You can send us an email if we've saved your life. It's mayo@bbc.co.uk. We'll read them out next week. This from Martin Gooding, BA. I've just watched a very impressive trailer starring Hello to Jason Isaacs, along with Patrick Stewart, Robert Carlyle and Natasha McElhone. It's called Castlevania, Lords of Shadow. It looks very impressive. Thing is, it's a PlayStation game. Will the good doctor be persuaded to revisit this genre by friend of the show, Jason? Be sure to ask him when he pops in with his thoughts.
But I think he's been on that for a while, hasn't he? I mean, I've seen his credit turn up on that for a while. Castlevania is a long-running video game, which I think he's just reprising his role.
Video games.
No, but
that's a good cast, though.
But and Jason Isaacs, yeah, absolutely. And Castlevania is meant to be quite good. I've got nothing against video games. I don't know anything about them, but I've got nothing against them whatsoever. And everything I know about them is stuff that I've read from Charlie Brooker, who makes very good arguments for saying that they're a great art form. And it is true that I have seen somebody playing Super Mario Galaxy, and it is indeed a very strange and bizarre work of art that does look like all the heaven sequences from that Peter Jackson film, Lovely Bones.
Reviews to come, by the way. Shrek 4 Skeletons, amongst those movies to be reviewed in just a moment. Self-reviewing taglines has been a long-running saga here. Melissa in Bellingham. The tagline for Ape, 1976, directed by Paul Leader, runs, "Not to be confused with King Kong."
Really? No,
that is the tagline. And then Melissa says, with an internet movie database rating of 1.6 out of 10, no, it probably won't be confused with Kong Kong. That's a terrible tagline.
Is that a real tagline?
Yeah.
Not to be confused with King Kong?
Apparently that's what it says. Okay, emails mayo@bbc.co.uk. So Shrek 4.
Ever After.
Shrek 4
Ever After.
Of course, that being the joke.
Shrek 4 The Money, or Shrek 4 Pointless, or Shrek 4 Heaven's Sake, or, insert...
Fill in blank
whichever one came. So, we've had three Shrek movies. First Shrek movie, great, exciting, really good, was really wowed by the CGI. I remember actually interviewing one of the guys that directed it and saying, I couldn't believe the texture of the cloth in the CGI. You remember that? And he said, yes, well, unfortunately...
Much loved apart from Jensen Button, who didn't like it.
So he didn't get it because he didn't understand why anybody would choose to be ugly at the end. Then Shrek 2, which was still surprisingly funny, still kind of did that thing about sticking it to Disney and, kind of in gags that sort of worked quite well. Shrek 3, which really felt like it had pretty much done everything. And now Shrek 4 Ever After, which is, okay, what else can we do? Oh, I know. This time what we'll do is we'll invent a backstory that involves Rumpelstiltskin making some pact before the action started, and then we'll do It's a Wonderful Life when Shrek makes a deal which takes him out of the world and he finds out what the world would be like without him in it. Here's a clip.
No matter what they take from me, they can't take away my dignity.
Donkey, what's going on? Do you know where Fiona is?
Shh, quiet, Ogre. You're going to get me in trouble, and I need this job. I am not going back to work for old McDonald. Tell me the E-I-E-I-O. E-I-E-I. No, that's what I said.
Where are my babies? And where's your wife, Dragon?
Look, Ogre, I think you must have me confused with some other talking donkey. I've never seen you before in my life.
Never seen me before? Come on, donkey.
Hey, and how you know my name anyway?
It's me, Shrek. Your best friend?
A donkey and an ogre friend? That's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard.
Can you at least tell me where they're taking me?
To the same place they take every ogre. To Rumpelstiltskin.
Stiltskin.
So, there we go. And it's very hard.
That was a good clip, wasn't it?
Yeah, very good. It's very hard not to just think, okay, this is one step too far. I mean, I did get the feeling with Shrek 3 that, you know, we've kind of run out of steam with this and it's served its purpose. The problem with Shrek 4 Ever After is, much as I used to like Shrek, I spent the whole time watching it thinking, it's funny just how old and tired this joke has become. The voice of Shrek itself has, you know, which once was kind of quite amusing. It's Mike Myers doing a Scottish accent. Why is that funny? Because it reminded me of, you know, I Married an Axe Murderer. But now it's just like Mike Myers doing that kind of slightly annoying voice. Eddie Murphy is Donkey, which is pretty much the funniest thing in the film. Singing songs out of context, that joke has worn very, very thin. The fact that they're tying themselves up in these knots, I think, you know, what else can we put? I'll tell you what it's like. It's like the digital animation equivalent of Polyfiller, in that there are no cracks left. That what they've done is they've constructed the plot entirely around whatever cracks were left in the Shrek universe. So we've now done everything, right? He's been single, he's been with the princess, he's been with the princess as Shrek and as the princess, he's had kids, he's gone back in time, he hasn't had kids, he's in a world in which he doesn't exist. He's like, it's all done. It's everything and it's all in there. So now if you looked at it and it was like a plasterboarded wall, it would be completely flat, now ready for painting. The Shrek universe has been completely sealed. The problem with it is it's such a joyless experience. And it's funny looking at it and remembering when I saw the first Shrek, thinking, wow, this is punchy and edgy and, you know, kind of doing really interesting stuff and, you know, coming in from the margins and making a real challenge. And now you just think, like, it's not that it's terrible and that there's nothing that's going to amuse young audiences. I mean, it's made, you know, with all the usual dexterity and skill of something which is produced at this level. But it's just terribly, terribly ordinary. And from my point of view, kind of depressing. How many of the Shreks did you see? Did you get as far as three?
I never got as far as three.
You got as far as two.
First two, pretty good.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's pretty much it. First two, pretty good. Three, didn't really need it. But four, I mean, it did remind me of Die Hard 4 Pointless. Just why? Why are we here?
But do you think they might be thinking Shrek 5?
Certainly at the end of the film, I came out of it going, well, the best you can say is that that's clearly it. And somebody else, a critic friend of mine, went, no, actually, there's a gap open in the end. And I thought, oh, no, that can't be right. So I suppose if the sums add up. But, I mean, it did look like a pretty final full stop
Shrek
to me.
Shrek 5 live, your World Cup station, every goal from every ground.
Shrek
maybe
5
That's the next one.
I'm sure there probably is a Shrek 5 in production even now. It looked pretty final. Can we move on to something more interesting, which we've both seen, which is Skeletons, which is the new movie, which is an and Jason Isaacs movie. At the end of the credits, actually do say and Jason Isaacs. And the story is of these two guys. I'm going to try and explain this story as best possible. You've seen it, so correct me if on my version of the story.
I would not even dream of doing such a thing.
Two strange guys walking the country, working as extractors. Their job is that they go to a house and they perform an extraction. At the beginning, we're not sure what the extraction is, but what we know is that the film is called Skeletons, and they have to go and find a closet. And when they go to the closet, they perform an extraction. So obviously, you know, took two and together, it's to do with extracting skeletons in the closet and somehow cleansing dark secrets. The two guys are run by a mysterious colonel figure, played by and Jason Isaacs.
I won't go into details, but Faulkner and Gabriel are no longer operational. Which means I'm looking for a new A-team. It's crunch time, boys. I need to know you can think outside the box, that you can use the procedure to its full potential. That's how come the change of job. Could be tricky. Data required on an absent subject. Gonna need some lateral thinking. But you get this right. Could be your ticket. Out the domestic, into the global stuff. Politicians. Aristos. Got the Saxe Coburg's lined up early next year. Imagine the filth. Make the goal of Jackie O look like the Partridge Family, eh? Don't let me down. It's your chance to shine.
Is it just me, or did Jason Isaacs sound a little bit like Sir Ian McKellen in that clip?
He does a bit. He has got the cloth cap on, yeah, as you would imagine from that. You might have listened to that and thought, I bet he's got a cloth cap on.
And a tash.
And it's a very, very good tash.
You can hear the tash in that. Now, here's the thing.
And if you were to compare Jason Tash's, that one with the Green Zone tash, it's slightly understated, really.
It is, but I think it's every bit as tash-tastic.
It is magnificent.
He is a man who knows how to wear a tash and to do an accent. Describing the film is very hard. I liked it. It's very odd, and it's it won a big award. It won the Best British Film Award at the Edinburgh Film Festival, and it is a very, very British film. It is a kind of film that you wonder how well it would travel. All the way through it, I was trying to think, how do you describe this? What is it in tone? Is it David Lynchy in tone? No, that's much too American. Is it Guy Madden-y in tone? No, that's, you know, that's not right either. I ended up thinking, is it like Poltergeist as redone by, you know, as a Hancock's Half Hour, but that would be a Sheila Hancock's Half Hour. And then I ended up thinking, actually, the thing that this is closest to in tone is there was a little scene, a British movie called Funny Bones. Did you ever see that? With Lee Evans, which was a strange sort of twisted comedy about a comedian who, underneath it all, was a psychopath. And it was very odd and very bitty and very weird. And I really, really liked it. And some people didn't get it at all. And there was something of that tone in this. I think Jason Isaacs' role that you heard the clip of there, he is really commanding on screen. And he's right in the centre of these two very strange oddball characters who are doing something which, because of the nature of the story, could so easily tip over into, I'm sorry, that's just, it's silliness. And I know you didn't quite get it in the same way that I did.
Well, it was slightly too odd. I wanted it to become, because I am essentially shallow, I wanted it to become a big mainstream romp based on the fantastic idea that they go around and they get people's skeletons out of closets, which seemed to be perfectly enough.
But that was what it was.
Yes, but then it went into the two guys, the weirdos, they go around and they start living in their dreams and levitating stones and all that kind of stuff. You don't want to be doing all that.
But it's a kind of, you know, it's everyday surrealism. It has that thing which I really, I suppose it's closest to magical realism. It's like that whole idea of these things are happening that are supernatural, that are strange, that are unusual, but they're being done in such a sort of down-to-earth kind of kitchen-sinky way. And that's why the thing works. When they turn up with these clipboards with forms that have to be filled out and, you know, T's crossed and I's dotted, and yet what they're doing is essentially bizarre, which is why, as I said, when I was watching it, I think, you know, is it has that kind of Lynchian sense of the everyday surreal. But when you say Lynch, it's got a totally different tone to it. The other thing I did like about it was it clearly didn't cost very much money, but I thought it was cinematic. It did look like a proper film. It didn't look like a TV play. It looked like a film.
Looked a bit with Naily.
Oh, actually, that's a very good comparison, which I wish I'd come up with in that case. It's like Withnail, as directed by Guy Madden, with an overtone of Funny Bones.
And look out for, as is described in the press release, rising British star, just because she's got the most magnificent name, Tuppence Middleton. I kid you not. That's not the character that she plays. Her name is genuinely Tuppence. I think that is fantastic.
And Jason Isaacs.
We'll do some travel, and what are we going to do next?
We'll do Heartbreaker. Heartbreaker.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Need any longer to think
about
it? No,
it's just that we've got so many to get through, and I'm trying to choose which ones we'll do. We're going to do Heartbreaker.
As in Dionne Warwick?
Why do you have to be a windbreak? I know, sorry.
Okay, very good. An appalling gag. Saturday morning Wittertainment here for the last time. Back next Friday between 2 and 4. Just on the subject of Jason Isaacs and skeletons, Dr. Adrian Brown, who seems to have 100 qualifications. Anyway, he was at the Edinburgh Film Festival for Skeletons.
Oh, yeah.
It included Jason Isaacs as the Colonel, having a splendid old time, says Dr. Adrian. Along with other cast and crew, he participated in a Q&A after the film, which was very well received. Tempted though I was to shout, "Hello, Jason Isaacs," I didn't, but I did mutter it under my breath, on your behalf.
Yeah, I'm sure wherever he goes, people do exactly that.
Do you think he's starting to hate us?
No.
On that basis.
No, in fact, he was interviewed by somebody and he was very kind about us, but then, of course, he would be.
Mike.
Hello, Jason.
Phillips. Indeed, hello to Jason, hello to David, Stephen, and all our other friends. And Michael as well, because Michael Sheen often gets left out and then feels a bit...
Yeah, and I'm just ashamed about all those oil hearings. I hope things
Mike
are going
says, there's a number of points on his email. Says, this is the first time I've contacted your programme. In fact, it's the first time I've contacted a radio show since back in the early 90s when Simon was doing the Radio 1 breakfast show. One morning, the listeners were asked, yes, there were two of us, says Mike, to contact the show with phrases that made them really depressed. Now, I'm trying to remember the context under which that would have been a good idea.
The Organist, you know, entertains?
I don't think that would actually ever become a spin-off TV series, would it? No. Get in touch now and tell us the things that really depress you. Anyway, I called in and I said that the one phrase that really depressed me was, Simon Mayo is on holiday for the next 2 weeks and is being replaced by Bruno Brooks. Second mention for Bruno on the programme. While Simon's Geordie female assistant, that'll be Diane, read out my comment, Simon said, you can't say that, in a not dissimilar way to how I've heard him say it on the podcast. Anyway, my wife, who was then my girlfriend, was driving to it listening to the show, and when she heard the comment, but not who it was from, thought, oh, there are all sorts of other people who feel the same way.
Very good.
Isn't that a nice
You
thing?
Did do a programme called Confessions. You could have done Depressions. It would have worked perfectly well.
Do you think?
Confessions, Depressions.
Okay. Don't get in touch Obsessions. With us this week because we're not here, but I think that could be a future long-running thing. Get in touch with stuff that makes you depressed.
Yep.
On the email. So what are we going to do before midday?
Well, let's nip through some releases quickly. So Heartbreaker, which on the post is described as, that, with his words, that sends me into a fit of depression, the smash hit French box office number one. Story
isn't
is,
that just kind of repeating itself as it works its way through that sentence?
Yeah, exactly. Le smash hit du number un du le box office de box de français. Okay, fine. So Romain Duris, the story is, and he's a very good actor actually, the story is that he's the heartbreaker. He's a guy who's professionally breaks women up from their partners. Okay, so he sort of seduces them away from their partners, but he has a strict code of morality, which is that he never sleeps with them, and he only breaks up relationships in which the woman is unhappy. She just doesn't realize she's unhappy. And at the beginning of the movie we see him doing that to one person, and then he is enlisted by this sort of slimy gang boss type figure to break up Vanessa Paradis, who is about to marry Andrew Lincoln, right? Vanessa Paradis, you know she is. Andrew Lincoln plays this guy who is suave, handsome, seems to be fairly decent, very rich, has his own jet, is faithful to her, and blah, blah, blah. Roman, our other guy, right, is a liar, a cheat, and disreputable, and he's and what's the and you get sitting there going, yeah, okay, where are my sympathies meant to lie? Ah, oh, I see. The thing is, though, the Andrew Lincoln character is English, and the Romain Duris character is French. Therefore, we have to sympathise entirely with the lying, cheating, philandering set up by the gang boss guy over the quite decent, straightforward, got lots of money, but you know, seems to be fairly, you know, nice about it, but basically boringly English. And I sat there thinking, at what point is this going to tip over and the satire is going to start? Where you go, no, no, that's not. That is the gag. That is the gag. You're meant to sit there and go, that guy I like, he's French. That guy, really boring, he's English. And
they're getting their own back for Robin Hood.
Yeah, they
where
are.
Clearly, exactly. The French are the source of all problems.
Exactly. So you should see this on a double bill with Robin Hood, but for no other reason. Moving swiftly on.
Do you think that's why it's been a number one in France?
Because I'm sure it must have added
the Anglo-Saxon vibe.
Certainly, if they were nursing their wounds after their World Cup showing, which was even worse than ours, I hear.
Shock, gratuitous reference to the World Cup when it was quite uncalled for.
That must have been, it must have been quite cheery. Can we move on to The Doors, When You're Strange, a film about, just called When You're Strange, a film about The Doors. It is a documentary about The Doors, as narrated by he himself, Johnny Depp. Here's a clip.
Like the Beatles and Rolling Stones before them, they perform live on the Ed Sullivan Show. And you hesitate, sir. Sullivan asks The Doors to take out the word higher because of its drug implications. They agree. During the performance, Jim sings the song exactly as written. Yeah, we couldn't get much higher.
A story which I think we have all heard several times, along with the fact that when Elvis went on, he wasn't allowed to be shown. But there's a very funny Ray Lowry cartoon with Elvis in the 1950s, or being told, I'm sorry, we can only show you from the waist upwards because of your lewd and disgusting hip movements. And then Elvis in the 1970s, I'm sorry, we can only show you from the waist upwards because of your ridiculous flared trousers. The problem,
I think we could maybe, because this is being videoed, of course, yeah, people could watch this. You should be shot from the neck up so people can't see your flappy hands.
Very good. Thank you very
what
much.
What do you think? Would that work?
Yeah, hilarious. The problem with, well, there's many problems with When You're Strange, a film about The Doors. Not least that I do think that Jim Morrison was a pretentious nitwit, and my interest in The Doors is passing. They did a few good pop songs. And when I was watching that Oliver Stone movie, you know, which was, have you ever read that book, No One Here Gets Out Awake Alive? Read that
no,
one?
But it's a like, joke that you like to make
I
every
do
time
like to
The
make
Doors
it, yeah. Have you ever read any of Jim Morrison's poetry?
No, just no. Enjoy the records.
Yeah, fine. Exactly. Some of them, good pop records. Hello, I Love You, good pop record.
Riders on the Storm.
Riders are perfectly fine. Not a great pop record, but a decent pop record. But the big problem is that this whole thing is... I mean, it's directed by Tom DiCillo, who I like very much. They haven't gone the route of doing interviews. What they've done is archive footage and, you know, recreating footage, got stuff together, put it all together and had it narrated by Johnny Depp, but in these incredibly somber tones. Now, the only way you could actually get away with doing a documentary about this is to be funny, because the fact of the matter is, if you don't find Jim Morrison passingly funny, he was just a flatulent old bore for most of the time. But this is delivered in such incredibly portentous and reverential tones that even the things that you know already seem incredibly boring. There's a bit at the beginning that says, at the age of 14, he was already reading Baudelaire, you know, Nietzsche, blah. You go, yeah, fine, I don't care. That's like the whole thing about, you know, yeah, well, I could play Stairway to Heaven when I was 16. Jimmy Page didn't write it till he was 27. I think that says quite a lot. There's one moment in which we are told very, very somberly that in the middle of recording the LA Woman or whatever it is, he said, Jim started repeating the phrase, Mr. Mojo Rising. He then wrote the letters down on a piece of paper and showed them to his friend. And the letters then animate in terms of Mr. Mojo Rising is an anagram of Jim Morrison. You go, yeah, well, you know, Finsbury Park backwards is crappy Robson. If it doesn't make it intelligent, it's just, it's fine.
So I could mention Newark at this point, but we probably shouldn't.
Newark?
Yeah, carry on.
Oh, okay, fine. So for one thing, I didn't think it had any sense of humour at all. I mean, I like Tom DiCillo as a filmmaker very much, and stop smirking at me because I don't understand the joke that you just made.
It's just an anagram, that's all.
I can't get there at all. Do you know what Robertson's Marmalade is backwards? Edlam Ram Snostrable. And so I'm watching this all the way through thinking, what you need is a sense of humour. And what I'm actually reminded of is I once had an argument with Camille Paglia, and how many sentences start like that? I had an argument with Camille Paglia in which she had argued in an essay that what rock music needed...
Who is she?
She's a very famous writer, Camille Paglia. That what rock needed was rock academies so that people could go and learn poetry in order to produce more rock musicians like Jim Morrison who were poetic. And I said, well, actually, that's the kind of place you want to burn to the ground. What we need is more Washboard Sams, people who could barely write their name, but knew how to turn a good tune. And I sat there thinking, if you love Jim Morrison and if you think that he's completely wonderful and total, you know, what you want is a hagiography delivered by somebody in incredibly somber tones, and you're going to get that. If, like me, you think that for most of the time he was a bloated old fool, then you are just going to get increasingly annoyed by the unbelievably serious tone of the film and the incredibly sort of sanctimonious, oh, it's so great. And it reminded me of watching the Oliver Stone movie, in which I did think Val Kilmer was perfectly cast as a guy who was so full of himself he didn't know which way to turn. It's like that Elvis Costello joke, you know, they say that travel broadens the mind till you can't get your head out of the door. Well, that was a problem that Jim certainly suffered from. Mr. Jimbo, he created this character Jimbo. People didn't know where it came from, but when he came out, they knew bad things were going to happen. You go, yeah, like the third album, but never mind.
So your dislike and disquiet with this film is pretty much based on the fact that you don't like Jim Morrison, which seems a little bit unfair on the movie.
It's that really. If you want, you can make a film about people you don't like, but you have to have a sense of distance. You have to have a sense of, you know, you have to have a sense of fun. You have to have a sense of something actually being amusing. The fact of the matter is, most rock stars are essentially stupid, and if you don't have a sense of that... I mean, I love Elvis, but any documentary that didn't understand that Elvis falling over on stage in the 70s was funny wouldn't be worth anything.
Robert Pattinson, it's the new Elvis.
He is, apparently.
He is, because we heard it from the horse's mouth.
What
did you think? You were very restrained during that particular sequence, that our Pats could be the next Elvis.
Well,
I thought you might blow up at that point.
Well, nobody's the next Elvis. Elvis was the next Elvis.
Well,
Elvis Costello. Elvis Costello was once asked, did you name yourself after the other Elvis? And he said... What other Elvis? I thought you were going to fill in that punch.
Movie of the week.
Oh, are we done? I can't mention White Material, Isabelle Huppert, Face Looking into the Abyss. We'll do it next week.
The news is on in a few seconds, so yes, we are done. The key being, you know, it's nearly midday,
skeletons.
Therefore we need to stop. You're kidding, really?
Shrek Forever After, like that? Movie about the Doors, you'd like that? Yeah. Or the movie, the smash hit number one French box office farce?
Oh, okay.
Or do you want Isabelle Huppert Looking into the Abyss?
Next week, we're back Friday at 2. Thanks for listening.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.